Hello, hello, hello.
Hey.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We'll expand ourselves.
Nice hat.
Oh, wait.
Oh, wait.
We can see each other. Hey, my video's off. My video's on. Here we are.
That's
look.
People. I can see people.
Hey.
Hi.
Whoever sound up.
Our sound.
I need to get my sound going.
Aha.
Hey.
We've got our sound going. Hello.
1 minute.
Hello, hello.
can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you.
I didn't know whether I'd put my, I'd changed my Skype back to my mic or not. So, hello everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Okay. It's up to you if you want to keep video on or not, because it's all audio, so we can save bandwidth or whatever works for you.
Okay.
It's, It doesn't matter.
It's kind of nice seeing your face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go with that, because that's okay. Because I'm going to audio hijack the whole thing anyway. So that's good. So, well, thank you ever so much anyway, before we start. That's really great of you to agree to come on.
Thanks for asking.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird because you guys are a band I've kind of been into since like the mid 90s. I was less grey back then, obviously.
I had hair back then too. So.
Time ravages us all like a monster that just cannot be sated. It's horrendous.
Hey, speaking of that, have you heard the rumors about Lou Reed?
I've heard that they're more than rumors. I've heard that Lou Reed is Lou Deed.
We haven't seen any confirmation from any reputable news source yet, other than RollingStone.com.
Yeah, Twitter's talking about it, but I don't know whether that's.
Yeah. See, everyone seems to be referencing the same article.
Yes. And
so it's kind of weird. I haven't seen it on any major news sites or anything yet. So
no,
it
might be some kind of rogue Rolling Stone person deciding to finish their career by saying Lou Reed has died. And Lou Reed's probably on the phone to them right now going, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah, we're hoping for that Lou Reed tweet to say the rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated.
Yes. Right, let me just kill the Wi-Fi on my phone. Shouldn't be hard, considering that iOS 7 managed to do that to the last one I had. So, okay. Right then. Basically, we'll be able to talk about anything you like.
Okay.
I reckon about 45 minutes to an hour. Sound okay?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the way the podcast has gone in the past, I mean, this is the 20th episode now, it tends to, it kind of rambles off into whatever it's going to be. So if it goes completely off topic at any point, don't worry about it. That's
great.
Fine. I also stick the explicit language thing on iTunes, so you can say what you like. I don't edit the show at all, unless you say something.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that was partly, initially, it was initially laziness that led to that.
Yeah.
But has subsequently become what I like to think of as an artistic vision.
Great.
Yeah.
We share your artistic vision.
That's how it should be. Editing's for people who need to edit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, we were just rehearsing earlier, and it's like, we were talking about recording, and the best way to get a good sound when you're recording is to create a good sound.
Yes.
The person recording you can't make you sound any better than you actually are.
No.
So
exactly.
That's a philosophy we try to follow.
Absolutely. You start with what sounds good and yeah. Right then, I will do a little introduction and then we'll just see where the winds take us with the podcast. Okay.
So let us ask you a question. How did you find out about us in the mid 90s? Were you in the UK in the mid-90s?
Yeah. Tell you what, hold that question and ask me during the pod, and then we can,
okay.
We can let the listeners hear as well. Okay, so I'm going to leave a little bit of silence so I can see it in the waveform afterwards, and then we'll introduce. Hello, everybody. It's episode 20 of Future Library. That's, I think, it's probably the third episode in a row where I've managed to get the number right without having to go, oh, shit, what is the number? So, yes, back again. Regular listeners to the podcast will be aware that there's been a little bit of a break, and then there was one last week, then there's another one this week, and there's going to be another one next week, because in the way it always is with the podcast, it kind of comes along like buses. There's a big gap, and then three of them all come along at once. And then you get spoiled, and then you get all expectant and go, oh, there's going to be another one next week. And then I leave you for 3 weeks. It's just the way I roll. So you've just got to get used to it. Anyway, today's guests, it's quite a change again. It's a little bit like when I spoke to Goody Pal and had him in the room with me. On tonight's show, I'm actually speaking to people on Skype, and I can see them, which is quite unusual for me. How to describe the guests I've got on tonight? They are a band that I first heard in the mid-90s. I think because of the circumstances in which I kind of fell in love with their first album, they've kind of stuck with me, and we'll go into that in a bit. They are from Austin, Texas, 16 Deluxe. Hello, guys. How are you doing?
Hello.
Hi, Alex.
Hello.
Hi.
It is a pleasure to have you on. The listeners are unaware that we were having a little chat before we started. It's the 16 Deluxe are a band that I have held very close to my heart for a very long time, simply because of the sheer amount of noise they were able to make, and the fact that they would wrap that noise around very poppy songs. And it just seemed the perfect combination. It's almost like the perfect band in that respect. And you were around in the middle of the 90s, and then you were gone for a bit, and now you're back.
Back.
That's right.
Back. Yeah. Well, we've been back for a couple of years, just sort of off and on, and it's been kind of a on again, off again, and now it's sort of on again. So.
Yeah. So how did that happen?
Well, the getting back together thing.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. There had been a bunch of people asking. They were just like, well, would 16 Deluxe get together again to play a party? Would 16 Deluxe get together again to play my birthday or things like that? And a mutual friend of all of ours convinced us that it would be a really good idea to do that. And the four of us, there's only three of us here right now, so it's Jeff, Steven, and myself, Carrie, and Frenchie is the noise master guitar player. He's busy making noise with other bands producing right now. But anyway, the four of us hadn't been in the same room in about 10 years. And so we decided that we were going to play a benefit for the Sims Foundation, which is, we don't have healthcare here in the United States, but the Sims Foundation.
Despite what you've heard.
Yeah. The Sims Foundation is an organization in Austin that provides musicians and their families with mental health and physical health benefits. So anyway, we decided we were going to play a benefit, and we all got together in the same room.
In this room,
there was not a singularity, and the Earth didn't explode, and there was not a rip in the space-time continuum. And we got together, and we realized how much fun we have playing together. So it's kind of like whatever BS that happened during the breakup of the band just kind of, it pretty much evaporated. It was just like, poof, gone. And everybody's just in a space now where we're ready to play music and remember what it's like to just, you know, have this thing that, you know, without sounding too cheesy, is really special. So we're just enjoying that.
Yeah, it seems that a lot of bands that were kind of initially around in the 90s are kind of coming back. And I think maybe it's that as people kind of, and we talked about this a little bit before the show started, about the whole effect of aging. I think maybe as people get older, they kind of go, yeah, what was that argument about? Or what was that about? I mean, the fact when I saw Lou Barlow back in Dinosaur, I thought, yeah, people are getting over it.
Yeah, anything's possible if that's possible.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that, I mean, that has to have been one of the bitterest breakups in indie rock history, the whole Lou Barlow leaving Dinosaur thing. Breaking the band up, telling him the band had broken up, reforming without him. It's the classic high school break up the band routine, but done on a band that was quite successful. And then you saw Pavement have come back, and the Pixies have been on and again, off again for a while.
Bloody Valentine.
The Valentines.
Yeah.
They just appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And actually the timing, I remember right before we got back together in 2010, I think My Bloody Valentine did a tour around that time.
Yeah.
And we were separately or at all at the show, and people were like, hey, when's 16 Deluxe going to get back together? And that's when we really started
Because we copy everything they do. So
yeah. Well, half of one.
Right. I just realized I've got slightly ahead of myself here. Obviously, I know who I'm speaking to, but yeah. The listeners might not. So do you want to introduce yourselves and say what you do in the band so that the people yeah. listening can get a picture and a flavor?
Okay, so I'm Jeff Kopas. I play bass.
I'm Steven, and I play the drums.
And I'm Carrie. I play guitar and sing. And Frenchie, who is not here, plays guitar and sings as well.
Fantastic. So that's enough detail for the listeners. Listeners, that's all you're getting. If you don't know this, listeners, you've got to go out and find this out. But not, but I have to say, not from Wikipedia.
No.
You know, I went to Wikipedia this afternoon to try and just refresh myself about some of the details. I thought, this will be easy. 16 Deluxe, Wiki, deleted for lack of notability. What, Wikipedia? What is wrong with you? These people yeah. who, yeah.
We have to talk to our manager about that. He was supposed to update our Wikipedia page for us and a couple of years ago. And I don't think he ever got around to it.
Yeah.
That was an awesome responsibility.
Yeah.
And we're sort of latecomers to a lot of technological things, but we have a really great Facebook page, you know.
And
you
a good Bandcamp page.
And a good Bandcamp page. So,
but, and you say that, and it's those two things that actually tipped me off that you were back together. You know, I kind of was listening to, isn't this terrible? It's in my head. Backfeed Magnet Babe?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, I was listening to that, and I was thinking, oh, I wonder if I could find any of their stuff online these days. And I looked up you guys on Facebook and thought, oh, I'll like them so I can tell the world that I like, you know, because those lists on Facebook are very important for future generations to let people know what we liked.
Right.
You know, that's to me is the, what it's like leaving Roman coins behind for future generations. We dig up the bones of the past and our ancestors, or our descendants, I should say, will be looking at our Facebook likes and going, ah, my great 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 grandfather liked 16 Deluxe. And there you go. So I thought that was important. So I did that. And then I kind of saw on there that there was a Bandcamp page. And then suddenly all this music was on Bandcamp. And I was like,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Finally, I can get a copy of the Pilot Knob EP.
Yeah. All our stuff is out of print. I mean, except for the Warner Brothers album that we did, which is still owned by Warner Brothers. But everything else was on small independent labels that are all gone. Dust in the wind now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we own all our masters and all our recordings. So we just said, well, let's just put them on Bandcamp and let people add them. Because, I mean, they're out there being traded on file shares and whatever, and they're poor quality. So we said, let's put good quality out there and, try to get people to, if they really want them, you know, just go get them. And if you want to throw a buck our way, that's great. If you don't, that's great too. Cause you're going to get them either way. So
yeah, I mean, because that's something that's been we've actually discussed about, talked about this with other guests on the podcast in previous weeks is the idea of, you know, how do you put music out there nowadays? What do you do? You know, now the music industry has completely collapsed, you know, which is, I think, kind of a good thing. But I think a lot of bands are doing what you guys have done, which is making their music available for free and saying, well, you know, if you want to give us some money, do. And I think
it's averaged out to being, I mean, it's still, even with all the people, if 90% of the people get it for free and 10% pay for it, you're still getting more money than you ever got from a record label.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's still, if you're getting a dollar on average per record, that's, you know, 50 cents more than a label ever paid you.
I like the trend of releasing the songs digitally and then, you know, vinyls made the comeback in the last 10 years or so, and then compiling things on like a special vinyl. So you can have the vinyl, but really people listen to digital music. That's just how everybody accesses music now. And for the connoisseur, you can have the vinyl if you want.
Absolutely. We'll hopefully be doing some vinyl in the next year.
Soon. Yep, so there are new songs in the works.
I was going to ask about this. Is there new material coming? And you've just answered that question. So is this going to be a new, is there going to be a new album, an EP?
We're working, actually, that's where we just came from. Kind of the idea is we're working right now on an EP, and what we may do is release one EP digitally, release the second EP digitally, and then compile them to make a vinyl LP for release at some point, you know, put it all together. we want to get music out, you know, within probably the next, what, 6 months?
6 months or something.
Yeah, six months. And, you know, it's taken us a while to get, like, we've been playing together again for a couple of years, but, you know, taking a step to make new music, that's a pretty big step, you know. We wanted to make sure we have the right material, you know, we go in the right direction with it, and, you know, we kind of live up to our back catalog. So, you know, we're working really hard on that right now. Jeff and Carrie have come to the table with a lot of great ideas, and, you know, we're recording demos now, and hopefully, you know, we'll get into the studio relatively soon and at least have, you know, a 4-song EP available for release, you know, at the turn of the year or so.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And it's been interesting because, you know, we had been playing shows, a couple shows a year since 2010, and we've been playing our old songs, and then it was just like, finally, like, okay, if we're going to be playing shows, then I want to play some new stuff.
Yeah.
Get to the point where it's like, we're being asked to headline shows, but we haven't written a new song in 15 years. So we kind of agreed, yeah, maybe we should go ahead and give the people some, you know, that want to see us, you know, some new music to perform live as well.
And I think it's not just for the people. I mean, for us as well, it's like, we get kind of, you know, it's not that we're tired of playing the old songs, but it just feels like you're just sort of spinning your wheels after a while, and you kind of question, well, why are we doing this? Like, if we're going to be a creative outlet, let's be creative and not just sort of, I mean, we could keep playing the same 30 songs over and over and people would love it, but, or hopefully love it, but it, for us, it's really just interesting to try to see where we can go with the skills that we have now.
Yeah.
Like, we've kind of picked up, we've all been playing, you know, apart from each other, and we've sort of acquired new skills, songwriting and playing.
Yeah. And
so we're just trying to put it back into a 16 Deluxe mold and see if we can improve on that, or
So like Jeff said, it wasn't like after 16 Deluxe broke up, everybody went away. Steven and Frenchie went on to play the Young Heart Attack, and Jeff and I have stayed active and busy with projects as well. It's like, it's not like none of us had been, we'd all consistently been playing music, so nobody ever dropped off the face of the earth as far as
rusty.
Yeah. And the thing that was really interesting is we branched out, and we live in Austin where it's ridiculous, the pool of talent that is in this town. So we had the advantage of playing with a wide variety of people that play different styles of music that are coming from different places. So like Jeff said, we got better at doing what we do.
Learn how to write a bridge.
Right.
Verse, chorus. Oh, a bridge?
A bridge?
Hey, that's cool.
Try that.
That's a neat idea. Well, it took 10 years to figure that part out.
But the other thing that was nice about, you know, growing up, you know, is realizing that 16 Deluxe is at its best when each of us does what we do best. There was a chunk of time when, you know, it's you're in your late 20s. It's all about ego. It's all about, I'm going to do this. Or somebody else is like, no, I'm going to do this. And I'm going to lead this. Or I'm going to pull that. And now everybody's just like, well, what do you do? Or what do I do? What do we do best as individuals? And we settled into that. It's like, oh, this is what works. So in the sense of keeping with the 16 Deluxe formula, it's more honest. So it's kind of more Backfeed Magnet, Babe, Honest, than, you know, some of the later stuff that we were doing.
Yeah.
Which was great for trying to spread our wings, but we're doing what we do, but I'm hoping that we're doing it better.
We've made a real conscious effort on the new material to say, you know, to ask ourselves the question each time, does this sound like 16 Deluxe? Because when you see a band like Dinosaur Jr. or somebody like that get back together, you don't want to hear what they sound like as mature adults. You want them to sound like what they sound like.
Yeah, absolutely.
You want them to sound like that band that you love.
Yeah.
And if they don't sound like that band that you love, then what's the fucking point, you know? They don't want to hear your Jazz Odyssey or your, I don't know. I'm not saying that, you know, people don't want artists to grow, but I think for certain types of artists, and if you're talking about bands getting back together, people want to see you for the reasons that they love you, you know, or that they like you or they're into you or whatever. And if you're not going to play to that, then I don't see why even bother, really.
Because ultimately we're a pop band too.
Yeah.
You know, you referred to that earlier, where it's you know, there's definitely a style over substance in a certain way where it's like very crafted sounds, very thought out sounds, but at the core of it is, you know, a pop song. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the reason you play pop music is so that people listen to it.
Short for popular.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you make an interesting point. I mean, I think if, you know, a lot of bands that have gone away and then come back, if they come back and do something very, very different, they're going to risk losing a lot of the people who originally liked them. I mean, if you look at somebody like Radiohead, who have stayed together and developed over all that time, if yeah. they'd have gone away after their first album, then come back 10 years later with something like Hail to the Thief or something, people would have gone, what the fuck's going on here? They've away this guitar band and they've come back this techno act. Whereas yeah. if
another band that was similar that stuck through was like the Flaming Lips. You know, they were a particular band, especially through the 90s, and then they made a pretty big turn, but, you know, people that stuck with it, it was a progression. It wasn't like, but if you had listened to Satellite Heart and then all of a sudden listened to Yoshimi, you'd be like, who the hell is this?
It's a completely different band, you know.
And I can speak from experience to say that it can quite heavily scupper your career, because, I mean, I played in a band called The Moths for a very long time. And that started out as like a noisy guitar band and then gradually kind of became... well, at the end, it was me and a laptop and doing kind of real fun on electronica. And to me, there was a constant, clear lineage from the start to the end, through all the releases. But because there was well over 100 releases in the space of 11 years, I had no hope of anybody ever keeping up with any of them, apart from me. so everybody who could have... liked one record would usually end up hating the next, and I just gradually over the years I kind of for the first I think the first two albums around about 2001-2002 there was a gradual kind of build-up of people liking it, and it kind of got, you know, reviewed in the NME on the second album and stuff like that, and, you know, I thought, yes, right, excellent, and then I thought, yeah, they'll come with me, they'll be right behind me as I spew out music. And I had this whole thing in my head that I could never release the same track twice, so I always had to give new material to whatever I did, if it was compilations or everything. So yeah, up to the second album, great, and then it went wrong. And I lost people. And every year from then on, I just shed listeners and reviews. And, you know, the year of getting lots of reviews is now a decade ago. And I'm lucky if I can get 10 people to listen to it now.
It's changed so much. It's so much more. You're swimming in a much larger ocean now.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's good. I mean, I think with the prevalence of people being able to record and release via things like Bandcamp, you're absolutely right. There's so many more acts out there now as well, that if you change and try to kind of maintain a long kind of changing career without being super, super successful, then you're completely boned. So I think what you guys are doing is absolutely the right way to do it. You come back, try to do something that's honest to how you want to work and reflects who you are now, but is also 16 Deluxe and recognizably 16 Deluxe.
Recognizable, yeah. That's our whole thing. Is like, it's got to be recognizable as you do. Otherwise, you're just sort of lost in this, like you said, a sea of people who are doing all kinds of different things, and you don't really have any identity. It's like you really have to sort of, you don't have to conform to your identity, but you have to be identifiable to stand out in this, you know, sea of just, you know, mass amounts of music.
In a way, it's fantastic how much there is out there, but there's just no hope of keeping up with it.
Yeah, I think there's a much more pushback. I hopefully see a pushback towards more of a gatekeepers. I mean, we need more good websites, good music reviewers, good people telling people here's what's good and here's what's not.
Absolutely. You know,
I think that's become a lost art in the last few years.
Well, it was actually a music review. It was a review in Melody Maker that first alerted me to the existence of yourselves. I think it was Everett True writing about you in Melody Maker.
We have some good stories about Everett True.
I actually played a show with Everett True once in Brighton. Wow.
He came to Austin in 1995. He was on a press junket.
And on the pilot knob, Hot Everett is about.
Yeah, we were.
It was our tribute to Everett True.
Yeah, Hot Everett on the pilot knob. It's sort of about Everett True. It's sort of about becoming popular and wanting everyone to go away. But, he came to Austin in 1995 on a press junket, for Trans Syndicate Records, which was our label we were on at the time. And he came to this show that we did at South by Southwest, which was like us and Bob Mould.
Ed Hall.
Crust. All the trans
John
bands. And so he was still drinking. He's sober now, but he was just on a bender with peppermint schnapps for I don't know how many days.
Peppermint schnapps.
And just stinking, polluted most of the time, and but really funny and brilliant, witty guy. And
I think
we ended up in a restaurant like real late at night with him, and he was under the table with coffee that we had ordered, and he was pouring schnapps into our coffee. And so we labeled that drink the Hot Everett. Cocktail, and that's worth of the title.
Starseeds
Cafe, yeah.
I think it might have been that show that he reviewed.
Yeah, I think that was the only time he saw us, and it was a great show, a great night.
Well, he wrote in the review that you played in Pitch Black with in the dark with lights on your heads.
At that time, in the Austin music scene, we were one of the youngest bands on Trans Syndicate. So, to me, like rock and roll generations are about 5 years. It's like when you start college and when you graduate college, it's like the music that you experience in that chunk of time is a generation. So, but anyway, the generation before us, heavily influenced by the Butthole Surfers, and involving multimedia. Mm-hmm. So, the punk scene or the post-punk scene in Austin was pretty much an art scene as well.
Yeah.
And you needed to, you didn't need to, but people wanted to. It's like it's a show rather than a concert. And so we wanted to involve the films. We wanted to involve the lights. The Flaming Lips and the other bands at that time too were just doing these things where it was like to transport you out of being in a club to having an experience, we wanted it to be psychedelic because Austin at that time was an incredibly psychedelic place to be. And, did we have, I don't remember if we had films. It might've been just like totally dark. If not, maybe
I don't think the films were part of it yet.
No. So we did like Christmas lights and the jewelers.
Yeah.
The jeweler's glasses. Yeah. But we always wanted to do something to stand out, whether it was films or lights, or it needed to be multimedia. It needed to be a show.
Well, it's funny because that reading that review kind of, I was playing in bands myself at the time, and that kind of inspired the bands I was in to try rehearsing in the dark to see what it was like. Firstly, we discovered it was very difficult, but secondly, we discovered that everything was crushingly loud in the dark.
We were the loudest band in Austin at that time, or so people said.
Well,
the competition.
It's a great thing to be, because at about the same time, way back then, I was playing in a guitar band called Cosmiche, and we were the loudest band in Birmingham. In the West Midlands.
That's saying something. Birmingham.
And we were really loud. I mean, we were loud to the point where, we were just much, much louder than everybody else. And I kind of followed that through into my next band. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience yourselves, where another band I was in a few years later, and I kept kind of always keeping the volume up thing, which again was down to you guys, was inspired by what you guys did. I was in a band years later called Magnetic North Pole, and we played at the 13th Note in Glasgow. And we were always loud, and we decided on the show we were playing that night, we had Brendan O'Hare from Teenage Fan Club was doing the sound. And he's really into his kind of metal and things like that. So he wanted things to be loud anyway. So he sound checked us very loud. Then before we started, we turned everything up as well. Because we knew Brendan. I know engineers hate that kind of thing, but Brendan's the kind of guy that would be like, yeah, about that. So we turned all the amps up. And at the same time, at that period, we were playing sets where we wouldn't stop between the songs at all. We'd get to the end, bit of feedback, then count, straight into the next one.
Yeah.
Very powerful.
Which is exhausting to do, if you've ever done it.
Yeah.
But it sounds cool.
I tell you, after seeing, we saw Sugar one time at a place called Liberty Lush here in Austin. They came out and they played 30 solid minutes nonstop, just literally just blowing everyone, off the floor.
I'll have to tell you my Sugar story as well.
It's like you just literally had to gasp for breath. And I think after we've seen that, we started sort of trying to copy that
yeah,
a little bit.
To make it a little tighter. But
yeah,
I wanted to jump back to the volume thing because, I mean, maybe, I don't remember quite whether it was a year or less than a year before 16 Deluxe formed, was the Dinosaur Jr. My Bloody Valentine show. It was Babes in Toyland, Dinosaur Jr. My Bloody Valentine. My Bloody Valentine was in the middle, and it was right after the glider.
It was Loveless.
Was Loveless out?
1992.
February 8th. We don't remember that at all. But it was at that show, the very end of the My Bloody Valentine set, they did, you know, they did their thing, the sonic blast, which sounds like a cross between a jet airplane taking off in your face and like a Saturn rocket going off right by your head. And it was something that, I mean, it was new to everybody in the club. It was, you know, people's brains were plastered against the wall, against the black wall, back wall, and it was just, it had such a huge impact, and it was just like, it was visceral. And so I know that everybody that was in 16 Deluxe walked away from that show just being like, that was a moving experience.
It was. There was actually a sense of terror about it too. Like, it was scary almost because it was so loud, and you kind of lost all sensory, you know, looking around at your friends and going, Are we going to go deaf? Are we being killed right now?
But this is exactly what happened at this show in Glasgow. We started the set, so we're not breaking between the songs, hit the first chord, and obviously it's coming back through the monitors, and at that moment I realised it was too loud. But there was no way to stop. Because we just weren't stopping. We couldn't stop and go, whoa, 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 we need to turn this down. We had to keep going. But I had that moment, and it's very much like you describe it. I had a moment where I suddenly felt intensely sick, and my balance went straight away. And I had to plant my feet and just grind through it. And I don't know if you've ever had the same situation where you start playing and you think, yeah, loudness is going to be cool. And then you start playing and you're like, oh, we've gone far too far this time.
I don't think we've ever felt like we've gone too far. We're always pushing to try to go farther. But I think we did learn early on about dynamics, though. To say, you know, you can't do that for the entire set. You can't do that relentlessly.
Yeah.
We always have sort of peaks and valleys.
But
we really like those peaks a lot.
And then also with trying to keep the melody intact, you know, on the albums, you know, the vocal melodies could come through, even though the first record, they're mixed pretty low in true 90s fashion, you know, they're kind of in the mix. But as we started working with more experienced producers like John Crosland and Mike McCarthy, and they were encouraging us to put the vocals more up front.
Yeah.
And it's just really hard to sing when everything's that loud.
Yeah.
So I don't know. So it was an interesting dance. So it made the record sound different than the live show, but we didn't, you know, it's like, do you want the noise? Do you want the melody? You want it both? Okay. Buy the record and go see the show. A little bit of both.
It's like you kind of had to know our songs to really sometimes even pick out, you know,
where the melody was
live, because it was always just, it was this constant battle to get the vocals above the band.
Yeah.
And you know, sadly, I think the vocals probably lost more than they won, but.
Well, I mean, you were saying you went to see Sugar. I mean, I went and saw Sugar on the Copper Blue tour. They played it.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
And it's one of these gigs that I've never forgotten, partly because it was so incredibly loud. I think it was the loudest gig I've ever been to in my life. And it was like, I've always described it to people as saying that, like, there's loud, and then a bit further beyond that, there's really loud. Then beyond that, by about a mile, is really fucking loud. And then if you go another 100 miles further, you've got a Sugar gig. And I remember,
I think I was really influenced by My Bloody Valentine too.
Yeah, I remember being kind of weirdly kind of semi-impressed and disappointed at the same time, because they came out and they played basically all of Copper Blue in order, which I thought was kind of cool, because I wanted to hear, you know, the first two songs back to back. I thought it was really nicely sequenced record. And they came out and it starts and it's really loud and they're playing the beginning of the act we act. And I'm thinking, oh, this is fantastic. And then Bob Mould sings the first line. So he's like there wobbling like his little Weeble thing with his guitar, and he's kind of goes, you know, and then the next line, he's like, and then he did that for the whole rest of the set, just bellowed it on a monotone.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that, I've seen footage of him recently, and it seems that he doesn't do that anymore. And I don't know if it was something he just did that night, or if it was a common theme in that era.
You know, I think everybody was really trying to push it in that era, because he was, like I said, I know he was living in Austin in the early 90s. We used to hang out with them when we were on Trans Syndicate. We had a lot of mutual friends, and we had friends who would house sit for him and go to his house. He lived in this beautiful, giant house in Austin. But, I mean, everybody was really trying to, I think My Bloody Valentine sort of threw the gauntlet down and said, this is how far you can take it.
Yeah.
And people were really trying to match that or go beyond it. And so, you know, I think that lasted for a while, and people realized, you know, you kind of, what My Bloody Valentine does is in a class by itself. You can't really go there.
Yeah.
And if you try to go there, you better come up with something unique or different. You know, otherwise it's just going to be a mess of noise, and you're going to have to be barking over your, your songs.
The thing with being loud, I think also, instead of just being loud, we kind of were like, well, we want to be loud and we want to sound good. And so there was also a trend in Austin on Trans Syndicate to include a sound engineer basically as an extra member of your band.
Yeah,
and that's something that I think is kind of, or was unique to Austin. Mm-hmm. So whoever your engineer was, you know, they were a solid person in your band basically for that chunk of time. And so
the guy that recorded Back in the Day was our touring sound guy. At least he's the only one crazy enough to know what
we were trying to do. But, you know, so it kind of raised, I can't think of a better word, but kind of raised the professionalism of it to where it's like, if we're going to do this and if we want to use volume as a tool, as like, you know, a performance tool, then we want this to be right. So, you know, a lot of people didn't understand. It's like, well, why do you have the expense of taking a sound person? Why are you taking a sound engineer? And it's like, we have to.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it will make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Because there would be, you know, really good sound engineers in different clubs that we went, but case in point, we played with the Jesus and Mary Chain in Irving Plaza. And while the Jesus and Mary Chain were sound checking, the guy, who I'm sure is a great engineer because he's at Irving Plaza, told William Reed that his guitar would sound better if he took some of that feedback out.
Whoa.
So I'm like, no, you know, it's like, we didn't want to take that risk. Yeah. It's like, because people, we did what we did and it was a specific vision, we knew that having a sound engineer was part of that equation.
Yeah, I mean, the way I approached volume over the years was I kind of, I don't know if you've come across them, the Canadian band Eric's Trip, who were from Moncton, New Brunswick.
Eric's Trip?
Yeah. Absolutely. Around the same time as I was into you guys, they were the other band that were kind of in my head. And their approach always seemed to be that you boost the bass and the mid-range and take the treble off.
Yeah.
And I found that that was a really good technique for getting things louder, because it then doesn't kind of tire the audience's ears out as much. Because really trebly kind of makes people just go, put their hands over their ears. Whereas if you've got that mid-range going, you can get it a lot louder, I found, without people going, oh, that's really loud. Because we don't seem to hear it in the same way, or it doesn't seem to cause us that pain. So I don't know, because I always thought, I mean, listening to you guys, it seemed to me, certainly on the records, it seemed that there was that quite nice kind of mid-range growl with the occasional, almost kind of
first
fluty
album,
stuff going on.
The first album especially, I think a lot of that was just due to incompetence on everyone's part who was working out. Like, if you listen to song, the levels are all different. The frequencies are all kind of, the EQs are all different. Because we were all literally recording in the studio for the first time. The engineer, it was his first album. It was our first album. So it was just sort of, you know, playing it by ear, literally from song to song. And we had so much high end going on, so much on the mid to high range frequency with the guitars that, you know, the low end sort of just was almost an afterthought. Like, all the concentration was on the mid to high side, you know, and only occasionally do you hear, like, there's certain songs like 413, where you really hear some nice fat kind of low end. But that was, like I said, that was as much just, you know, being beginners and not really knowing a lot about the frequency range.
But I still think that record sounds fantastic. I mean, I think every single track on it sounds great. Going right from that opening cover of Here Come the Warm Jets, which I still think has got one of the best guitar sounds of anything I've ever heard. I think the whole record's really... I think it's just a really fantastic record. I mean, the reason it sticks in my head is that it was it 95, 96? 96, was it?
95 it came out.
95 it came out, yeah.
Christmas 94.
Yeah.
Over Christmas break.
Because it came out at a time when my life was kind of going very, very strange. I was at university. I was about to get married to somebody who I'd kind of met somebody else, and... My memory of it is going to see this other person in my Citroen 2CV car with Backfeed Magnet Babe on the stereo, driving down dark country lanes late at night and singing along to it as loud as I could, listening to it. So it kind of, because it was during this very kind of stressful period of my life, it kind of, I think it stuck because of that.
Right. Well, I hope we brought you some peace or some release or something.
Well, I think it's...
It's kept you from making the wrong decision in life,
perhaps. Well, you know, I'm...
There are so many wrong decisions that we made for you around that time.
That's what we're here for.
It got to the point where I had a battery that started to fail in the car. And I remember coming home from seeing this person one night and having to choose between the stereo and the lights. And eventually, I tried to keep the stereo going as long as I could. And eventually, the stereo had to go. Then the lights were fading as well. And But I think it's important to have records like that that kind of have an emotional resonance because they kind of sit in that period of life. I mean, the other two records at the time that were listened to on rotation, it was the three records of the year for me that year were Backfeed Magnet Babe, Disgraceful by Dubstar. And In the Space of a Few Minutes by Telstar Ponies. So it was like two guitar bands and one pop band. And you guys kind of sat between the two because Telstar Ponies were very kind of angular and kind of almost krautrock because of what Dave Keenan and Brendan O'Hare were wanting to do. And then Dubstar were pure pop and synth pop. And then you guys kind of sat almost at the perfect junction between the two bands of this almost pure pop thing with this... Yeah. Kind of really corrosive noise, which I thought was a fantastic thing. As I said before, it's still one of my favorite records of all time.
Right. Well, all of us were really in it, very much in the krautrock, very much in prog, like early prog, like
Amandul,
Can.
Lots of late nights with Can.
Yeah.
Tiago Mago.
A lot of Can very early on. And but at the same time, like Cheap Trick and ABBA and. Things like that, T-Rex, those were all huge influences on us. I mean, the Sweet, Roxy Music, that's all in there on Backfeed Magnet Babe, but it's really the sum of all of our influences up to that point in our life. And I mean, it's just all of that mixed together in a big ball. And I don't think at the time we really knew how we were doing it or we weren't conscious of it really. That album is just us playing our live set in the studio. It's just us playing live.
The big star song, Kangaroo, when we were, I had recorded it actually at Lyman's house? Yeah, it was before we were roommates. It was at Lyman and Pete's house. I had a four track. It's just, you know, the thing that's so great about that, the big star recording is it just, you know, it's this beautiful little pop song, but there's that part of it, like the guitars sound like they're recorded from across a canyon. And I was just like, that's what I want to do. We want to mix that with the Butthole Surfers. So how do we do that?
Well, I think it was very successful. I mean, it's actually funny you mention Kangaroo because somebody posted the, this Mortal Coil version, I think, on Facebook the other day. And I went and listened to the Big Star version, which, to my shame, was the first time I'd listened to their version. So it's quite fresh in my head. I don't know exactly what I mean. I can listen to it. I thought, whoa, this sounds really kind of out there for the band they were.
For the time period and the place, it was very off.
And it was funny because the first the first time I had heard the song was This Mortal Coil, because I was totally into all the 4AD bands, all of that stuff in high school and college. And then, was it you or Mark Fagan?
I brought it home. I was a DJ at a radio station. We got all the Big Star reissues, as promo copies, and I brought them all home.
I was like, ooh, it's that This Mortal Coil song.
And me and Carrie were roommates at the time, so we would just listen to them, and that and the Chris Bell as well.
Yeah.
Although no, actually, when I met Frenchie,
that's when we got.
I went to his Frenchie's house, and he said, "Oh, you're in the Big Star. Have you heard the Chris Bell record?" And I was like, "Chris Bell? No." And he played me "I Am the Cosmos," and that's when that's basically when our friendship began. I was like, "Oh my God, I've never heard this song before. It's amazing. This guy knows." It's like Chris had the other piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where that's how everything started.
Fantastic. So
influence.
with what's happening now? You're back together. You've said this new song. So what else is coming up next for 16 Deluxe?
Well, you know, besides recording the new material, we're always game to play a show for the right reasons at the right time. I mean, we really have this luxury now that, you know, we can say, well, this sounds like fun, you know, an opportunity to pop up, and it's like, well, is everybody going to be in town, or, you know, okay, so there's that. And then can we do a show the way we want to? Because it takes a certain amount of effort and a certain amount of coordinating to make a 16 Deluxe show. We still, to me, the lights, the films, the multimedia aspect is still one of the top priorities. So we need that, and we need the right sound person, we need the right venue. So it's like the stars have to align, and if they don't align, we're all relaxed enough to say, maybe
it's not
next time.
It's not in stars.
It's not the end of the world. Yeah. If, you know, back before, if we had to miss a gig, that was awful, and we rarely miss gigs ever. You know, we would play virtually anywhere, but now if something doesn't work out just right, you know, it's like, well, we'll play next time, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot less stress around this time.
Yeah.
We're much more choosy about things like that.
Right.
Much more particular.
Choosy in this way where it's just kind of like playing together, I mean, honestly, it's a real joy. When we get together, and whether we're writing or whether we're playing live lately, it's wonderful. And we don't want to play any BS shows that are going to take away from, I feel like it's a feeling that, you know, we've paid our dues for, so we should be able to enjoy the time that we have to play music.
We've already done the work side of it. It's like, if it feels like work, we all have jobs. We have day jobs.
Yeah.
So like, if it feels like work, we're not going to do it, you know.
And that seems to be a very reasonable way of looking at it.
It's got to be like fun. And so we just, the agreement that we had in 2010 when we first got together was, we're only going to do something if it sounds like fun. So that's really where we're at. You won't see us doing some month long tour or, you know, out slugging it out in a van across the United States for a summer. Like, that's just not in the cards anymore for us, but for various reasons. But, you know, weekends here and there, and occasional high-profile gig.
Yes.
South by Southwest is great because the whole world comes to Austin, and we get to kind of show off for the whole world. So, and next year is our 20th anniversary. So, you know, who knows what that'll.
So,
mean,
Jesus,
you know,
and Mary Chain want to invite us to Scotland. We'll do that.
Yes, please.
Well, some of the guys who the website that actually hosts the podcast for the first week of its release every week is based in Scotland, and various people know people, so I'll get it passed on.
Right, put the word out.
We're
ready.
There you go. Jesus and Mary Chain, they're ready. 16 Deluxe are ready. before we wrap things up.
Remember
Long Fin Killy? Well, fantastic. Luke Sutherland.
We toured with them in 1995.
In Medicine,
Long Fin Killy, 16 Deluxe. This was a triple bill that went around America in 1995. And everything we know about Scotland comes from Long Fin Killy. They told us the entire history of Scotland every night in our hotel rooms when we were drinking after the shows. They would tell us the history of the Scots.
Yeah. I used to live up the road from where they were. I used to live up in Dundee in Scotland. I was actually born in Glasgow, but I've spent a lot of my life in England. I lived just up the road from Long Fin Killy about 10 years ago. And so, I mean, because they were from Perth,
Right,
which is about 20 miles south of Dundee. And I, fantastic band. I remember playing friends of mine, the Lamberton Lamplighter, and them going, what's this? Oh, it's really quiet. It's really loud. Yeah.
Very dynamic band, very dynamic.
Very fantastic band.
Imagine them, and then us, and then Medicine. That was the bill that went around for about 3 weeks around the United States. It was quite a tour.
That's the dream.
A lot of memories. Yeah.
But yeah, the fantastic. I don't know what Luke's doing nowadays. I know that he was in Bose, and then he went off to be in Music AM for a bit. I know he's writing books as well, but I don't know what he's doing these days. I'll find out. Maybe I'll
hear from him. Tell him we said hi because still have fun.
I'll find him. I'll get him on the podcast and I'll send you a copy.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Great.
Before we wrap things up, though, I do have one question, and it's something that I've wondered about since 1998 with Amidst Showers of Sparks. Captain Kirk's Z-Man House of Fun.
One word answer. Drugs.
There we go.
That's the explicit warning. It's whatever you think it is, the answer is yes. I think the answer to everything at that in that era was yes.
Yes. We were saying yes.
Just
to
say most, yes.
We were saying yes to most everything around that time.
Yeah. And the other thing, actually, I know we'll ask actually another thing about this, because I'm actually looking at the webpage with all the covers on of all the records.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and I'm hoping you're not all going to go, you bastard, after this question. The idea of Honey 7-inch cover fantastic, Batfig Magnet Babe cover fantastic, the Pilot Knob cover very good. Actually, the Pilot Knob cover, wasn't that the one that the My Bloody Valentine cover looks suspiciously like?
Yeah, it's very,
it looks very
purpley and blue.
Yeah. We're 20 years ahead of our time.
Yeah, then Amidst Showers of Sparks cover fantastic, the Moon Man is Blue cover interesting, a good cover. Then Vision Take Me, Make Me, Never Forsake Me. Not feeling that cover as much.
Talk to these guys. I quit the band. I quit the band. I take no responsibility.
Steven's
going to
take this one.
Yeah.
Are you going to go get it?
Well, he's going to bring you a visual. But I quit the band before that album came out. And if they had proposed that artwork, I would have quit again.
We really liked this album at the time.
Right. Okay.
Super Sessions.
For the audio listeners, we're being shown a cover of a record that I can see what you're doing now with that. Yeah.
And I think around that time, too, I mean, you know, with that album, we were trying to do, if you look on the credits, you know, invite every friend that we had to play on it. You know, it was really trying to branch out musically, and I don't know. At the same time, as far as artwork and stuff, I don't really think we were as much in communication or concerned about it, really. I mean, you know, we definitely, you know, that was towards kind of the end of round one, and I guess art was secondary, really, you know.
It was,
and it really was just about this. Like, what should we do for the album cover? Should we put a photograph? We've never had a photograph of us on the record. You know, well, let's model it after the Bloomfield Al Kooper, Stephen Stills record. Naturally.
Of course.
As Rick James would say, cocaine's a hell of a drug.
That's right.
You see, the thing is, now you've shown me that makes sense. And I recommend that all the listeners go and check out the comparison. I think it doesn't especially matter, because I think the record itself sounds fantastic. I mean, you've got the strings on there. You've got all sorts of things. You've got some actually really quite beautiful pieces of music on there that, you know, are a long way from the kind of earlier fuzzy stuff, and you've got these really elegant string parts, but I can't remember which track it is with is it the Red River Anger Management Society?
I love that song.
Yeah, the last song.
Yeah, and is that the one with the long coda with all the strings at the end?
Yeah,
it's
beautiful.
Yeah, that's
the thing that I like a lot about that is that it's still got the melody also being played on a very distorted guitar. And it all seems to fit in with the strings and the guitar. All, you know, all sounds really nice. I'm a fan.
Yeah,
right. Great. Well, it's one of our favorite recordings. I mean, I think it's I think in our minds we went out kind of on a high note. Like up to that point, we were throwing everything we had in that recording. It was the first album that we did all entirely on our own, pretty much.
Yeah.
In our own studio, on our own time, we spent months and months working on it.
Yeah.
And so we really just, it's like everything in the kitchen sink on that record. And it's a shame that I think it's a shame we broke up, because who knows what we would have done right after that in the subsequent years, you know?
Yeah. It's really interesting because our peers at the time, you know, I'm really glad that everybody in our band has taken the paths that we've taken, but you know, you always think about the what ifs, because I look at, you know, And You Will Know Us by Trail of Dead and Spoon, and you know, there's something to be said for just stick-to-itiveness and tenacity. And it's just like, I don't think that would have really been an option for us at that time. I don't know if it would have really made sense for us to just barrel through what everybody was individually growing through at that point in time. But, you know, there is that thought. It's like, well, you know, Spoon just plowed through.
Yeah,
until
they're going on 20 years.
Yeah, until they're where they're at. But it's hard fucking work. And the same thing with Trail of Dead. They just kept going and going and going. Or the Flaming Lips. Or like all these bands that are just like, I am going to stay here and do what I do. But it's a very demanding lifestyle. It's a very, you know, it's a very demanding thing to be in an indie band that's just below, you know, kind of made it, because we were still doing van tours and we're still supplementing our music with day jobs. It's just, it's a
hard life.
For me, it was an unsustainable lifestyle, but it's just kind of, and you know, maybe that's different. It kind of goes into the whole thing too, of like being the only girl in the band, where that particular lifestyle, I think, was a little bit harder for me to sustain. But regardless, it's like we are where we are right now, and I think the band as a whole is much better for it. I feel like the music that we're making now, whether we're playing the old songs, you know, in our current configuration, or if we're writing new stuff, I really feel like it's the best we've ever sounded.
Yeah, so. It's like the character in Lost said, what happened, happened.
Yeah, exactly.
You just have to live with what happened, and it is what it is. And, you know, you
what did happen? I mean, I lost. Not with us, but yeah.
Oh, you just have to watch it again. I thought the end of Lost was great. I know a lot of people hated it, but I really liked the end of Lost. I couldn't see how they could have ended it any other way, but, you know. And on that bombshell. Anyway, I should let you go. I've got to scoot off and spend some time with my lovely wife this evening as well. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you guys. I hope to keep in touch, maybe speak to you a year or so down the road, see how things are going then. From what you're describing, I think it sounds to me that you've got, you know, the perfect setup now, that you do what you want to do when you want to do it. You're doing it because you enjoy it. And I think that's, you know, that's success.
Thanks, Alex. That's very, very encouraging.
Yeah.
We'll keep in touch.
So yes, the nobody from the UK has pep talked you.
Thank you.
And I want to clarify, just before I finish the podcast, I want to clarify that occasionally, obviously this is a visual thing for the people listening, they're not going to know what's been going on, but during the podcast, I've been drinking from a very large glass. And I was kind of wondering if these guys had seen this and were wondering, what the fuck is he doing with that glass?
Blood. It's blood.
It's the blood of, something.
It's the blood of Christ.
Blood of Christ.
And it's also, I have to point out, it is a large glass. It isn't that I'm very small. So, So I was given it as a present years ago for Christmas, and for a long time I saw no purpose to it. And since I've moved into my new house a few weeks ago, it's now my go-to glass. So, I wanted to explain that.
You can tell your wife, I'm just going to have one drink, honey. Just one drink.
Yes. Of blood, of the blood of Christ.
Pour that into your 64-ounce glass there, and got it.
And you have to say, I mean, you know, is one of the blood of Christ enough?
That's right.
One's too many, and a dozen's not enough. That's kind of our motto.
Of the blood of Christ, or of just any drink?
Of the blood of Christ.
Of the blood of Christ. Yes. I mean, so there we go. That's the top tip from 16 Deluxe of how much of the blood of Christ you should drink.
This is going to be very strange.
Well, guys, it's been a pleasure. Where would people go to find out more about 16 Deluxe if they were to go on their computing devices?
On your computing devices, the best place to go, I think, is Facebook. If you're on Facebook, it's just facebook.com/16deluxe.
If you're not on Facebook, and more power to you if you, you know, want to have a life offline, bandcamp.com/16deluxe. And we also have a, there's a website that's not quite live yet, but I'll go ahead and throw it out there. It's 16deluxemusic.net. That's going to be like sort of our new homepage website. It's still a work in progress, but you can go there. And
you've still got the old .com ones up there as well.
But, yeah, that one hasn't been updated in a while. We're sort of going to point that towards the 16deluxemusic.net site. So yeah, we're kind of lacking on the web, website side of things. It's really relying more on the social media and the Bandcamp thing. It's just so much easier. We're so lazy. It's really the answer.
And the thing as well, the thing with that kind of thing is you get the instant feedback of how many people have bought records. You get the little email saying so-and-so has just paid you $7.
It's great.
And that's kind of nice, isn't it?
It is kind of nice. Yeah. It is kind of nice.
Yes, absolutely.
And those, getting those little likes from,
like.
From someone in, you know, Saudi Arabia or Patagonia or Birmingham. You know, it's really kind of exciting. Every day you see a little, like, oh, this is another little pinpoint on the map where 16 Deluxe people are listening, you know. So it's pretty cool.
And of course, the one place that we won't speak of is Wikipedia. Fuck Wikipedia.
No. Well, Wikipedia.
That's right.
The next call we're going to make after we get done with use to our erstwhile manager.
Wikipedia.
Ask him why he hasn't updated our Wikipedia.
I kind of imagine that call. You're going to be on the phone. You're going to go, what's his name, your manager?
His name is Austin C-Ed.
So you're going to be on the phone. You go, Austin. And he'll be like, hey, hi. And he'll be like, one word, Austin, two syllables. Wikipedia. And he'll be like, that's more than two syllables. And you're like, fuck you, Austin. Wikipedia. What's going on?
That's going to be the end of him. Yeah. We'll have to fire him after that.
He'll go, shall I get my bag? And you'll go, yes. I think don't even bother collecting your stuff. We'll send it on to you.
And we'll delete him from our history.
Austin who?
Right.
And on that pop show.
Already forgot who we're talking about.
Fantastic. Right. Good luck with what's coming up. I will keep an eye out. I will encourage everybody who's listening to do the same because you're a fantastic band. Thank you for speaking to me.
Thanks for asking us.
Thank you.
And all that's left to say is a future library goodbye, which is a bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Where you going to Friday night? Oh yeah, I've been a wonder.
fantastic. And you did the bye-bye, thank you. So many people at the end of it, I go, oh, we'll do the bye-bye, and everybody just goes, I go, bye-bye, and everybody just goes... And it's like, oh.
It takes stage direction well.
Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com, where you can go and find out various things about people who we've talked about and various people who haven't been on the podcast yet, but might be in the future. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/FutureLibrary1, so that's Future Library with a number one. And you can email me at alexbottom@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe via iTunes. Just search for Future Library there. That's it. Thanks.